The annual coincidence of President Washington's birthday, Brotherhood Week, affords some rather sardonic amusement to many Americans. But whatever his other claims to fame, Washington, I'm afraid, will always be known to the American people for that rather priggish bit of self-righteousness, I can never tell a lie. And Brotherhood Week, in the minds of some, is the ultimate hypocrisy, sham, pretense, pious, empty masquerade. The good ladies invite their neighbors to visit each other's churches, the Jewish synagogue, as if there's any other kind, and their husbands invite the neighbors to an evening supper in the church basement, probably the one occasion during the entire year when most of these men will have a purely social interreligious evening. Now, Brotherhood Week may be a self-delusion, but it's not a deliberate hypocrisy. It's not an attempt to paint the black white. Rather, it's a statement by the decent middle in the American society that they really feel that good fellowship, good neighborliness, are not only the vision of American life, but more or less the stuff of its reality. And if this is not in fact so, this testifies more to their spiritual blindness than it does to any attempt to deceive themselves. I'd like to examine this concept of spiritual blindness. Let's take a word, the word racism. Now, in recent months, years, the young have verbally escalated this word till it seems to have no meaning. They label as racist anyone who doesn't agree with their particular priorities of social reform. I saw a wonderful glossary of current idioms in the New York Times recently, in which a racist was described as a gentleman of another color with whom you happen to be having an argument. But when the Kerner Commission, the Presidential Commission on National Disorders, labeled our nation racist, they had a very specific connotation in mind. They did not mean that we were all George Wallaces. Far from it. But they meant that most of us are blind to the ways in which our institutions conspire, burden those on the other side of the color line. And not necessarily out of any deliberate intent in the minds of those who created those institutions. Let's take it as an example the educational gap, the difference in levels of attainment gained by the students in the core city and in the suburbs. It's not simply a product of cultural deprivation, but that, of course, is an important factor. The Sutter City has one half the amount of money to spend per child per year as do some of our more affluent suburbs. The teachers who are given a choice between teaching small classes half the size in the suburbs and oversized, overstuffed classes in the city, inevitably at some point weary of the challenge which is beyond anybody's fulfillment year after year and go to the suburbs where they can find somewhat an easier life. There are the questions of school districting and redistricting. There are the questions of tax base. There's the differential in available funds, in available teachers, in available plant. And none of this was deliberate, but all of it is a fact. And those of us who assume that because we pay our taxes and there is public education for all, and therefore equality of opportunity for all, are simply obtuse, blind. We simply refuse to see or cannot see the implicit, built-in injustice of the present system. Now let's take for a moment a look at the second monstrosity of Western civilization, not racism, but anti-Semitism. Here too, there are two degrees, two kinds of anti-Semitism. Just as there's the racism of a George Wallace and the blindness, which the Kerner Commission chose to label racism of most Americans, so here too, there's the verbal ugliness of a George Lincoln Rockwell, and the silent, often unexpressed, often unconscious anti-Semitism of the vast majority of members of Western civilization. For anti-Semitism, unfortunately, is part of the dark inheritance of Western man. And you know, the neighbor who comes to a Brotherhood dinner, who throws his arm around our shoulder, with whom we spend a very pleasant evening, likes us. He cares for us. He's very honest when he speaks of his neighborly feelings. But he learned something else in the cradle. He learned of Judas, and of the Christ killer, and of Shylock. He learned somehow that the Jew is the unassimilated alien. The Jew has been the target of much literature and much poison and much venom and much political hate. And so though he is often unconscious of this inheritance and most often does not act on it, it exists, it is latent within him. And it can at times be churned up, brought out by social unrest, by the demagogue. The degree of his blindness can be measured by the fact he's simply unaware that the executive suite in which he spends 9 to 5 every day has no Jews on its roster, that the downtown club where the president of his corporation conducts so much of his business has no Jews on its membership rolls, that the social club where he spends most of his time has no Jews among its membership. He doesn't mean anything really when he says to a competitor or to a client, "Don't worry, I won't Jew you down." But he does, though he may be unaware of it. He's expressing the simple fact that Western civilization has conditioned him, impressed him, so that given certain situations, the Jew will become, in his eyes, the target, the enemy, the evil within the society. Now, I've very rarely spoken to you from this pulpit about anti-Semitism. For one fundamental reason. Anti-Semitism in this sense, as the struggle between a man and his own decency, as the ability of a member of Western civilization to surmount his own conditioning, his own inheritance, this is fundamentally a Christian problem and not a Jewish problem. There's almost nothing we can do about it. When the Vatican Council was convened and got around to the question of deicide, they didn't do it because Jews had asked them to review the question of the Christ killer. They did it because of the needs of the theology of the church itself. And I'm afraid that all of the pamphlets which we have written over all of these years setting right the facts, all of the speeches that we have given over all of these years showing chapter and verse of our citizenship and of our accomplishment and of our neighborly concern, I'm afraid that all of this doesn't really make an impression until that man or that woman is determined, for reasons of his own or her own, to surmount the stereotypes, to get beyond the ideology, the preconceptions with which he or she was nurtured. When those who voted for Hitler in 1932 were asked by reporters, you know, why did you cast your vote for him? Many said, because he's good for Germany. But of course, we don't agree with his Jewish attitude. And they were saying what? Simply, that they have no conscious desire to affiliate themselves with an anti-Semite, but they find unconsciously no high barrier which precludes them from doing it. Their anti-Semitism is latent, potential, nevertheless real. Now, why do I break this tradition? Why do I speak to you this morning of anti-Semitism? Because there's another level on which anti-Semitism exists, and that's an open, calculated political level, in which anti-Semitism is manipulated by some demagogue, by some ideologue, by some small group, in order to churn up the passions of people to gain adherence for their own particular end, to create a target, an enemy, the Jew, in order to gain followership and power with their particular program. And I am concerned, frankly, that after perhaps 20 years in the United States in which anti-Semitism has not been part of the coin of political debate, has not been used by the demagogue. The McCarthy era had many evils, but anti-Semitism was not one of them. But after some 20 years in which we have been relatively free in this nation of this ancient poison, there is some danger that it's surfacing again. And we ought to take this into consideration. We're going to make our plans accordingly. Now, of course, the focus in which you all recognize this discussion takes place is the focus of what's called black anti-Semitism. Black anti-Semitism has been much on the lips of Jew and non-Jew. There have been all these reports of an occasional outburst of anger by some black militant in which he'll say something to the effect of, well, Hitler didn't get enough of you. Or there's the poetry of some of the intellectuals in the black movement who rhapsodize about the Jew pig. And of course, there was this massive confrontation in New York City between a largely Jewish professional teachers' union, a largely black neighborhood educational board, school board. But I'm afraid that most of this discussion has been out of focus. It hasn't reached the issue. It didn't clarify things for us. For the issue really isn't whether or not among blacks, among Negroes, there is the same kind of potential of latent anti-Semitism which we recognize in this larger society, but whether or not there is among the blacks and among the whites groups who will deliberately manipulate these latent feelings, bring them to the surface, bring them into the arena of effective political action. During all the discussion, the Times article in the Light about the tragic confrontation, black, Jew, and so on, there were a lot of articles written by very eminent sociologists to the effect that in the studies taken so far among blacks, they have shown somewhat less anti-Semitic stereotype thinking than have the general white population among us. But that's small comfort, because the real issue is not whether or not 90% of the body politic is poisoned or 85% of the body politic is poisoned. The real issue is whether there is not somebody, some group, we're planning, trying to seize hold of this poison, to spread it broadly, and to use it for their own purposes. And I'm afraid I think there is such a group. I began to see it surface about 3 years ago, when the relics of an organization which had been called the Students' Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, a group which had originated in the South during the early days of the Civil Rights Movement and during those early days had done yeoman service, a group which had fallen subsequently in the hands of black militants who were not only black militants for civil rights in the United States, but who were attached to the New Left, to the Third World, whose heroes were not Martin Luther King or Roy Wilkins or even Malcolm X, but Mao and Che Guevara and Franz Fanon. This small group numbered perhaps less than 200 men. It was Mechoula, bankrupt. And then suddenly it began to publish in its newsletters cartoons and articles which were taken whole out of the papers of Baghdad and Cairo. And you began to see in these cartoons, or you saw, you couldn't help it, the stereotyped Jew of the protocols of the elders of Zion. Long nose, stoop shoulders, salivating. His flag was always the dollar sign. He was always predatory. He was standing astride some poor, defenseless little Arab girl, apparently intent on raping her. And this material was broadcast, because here was a very interesting marriage of convenience between a militant, radical, black militant group, desperately in need of funds to keep itself going, desperately in need of a new emotional impact upon the community which had largely rejected it, of Arab groups which were desperately looking for some body politic in the United States which could fight their fight for them. Arab propaganda has never made a major impact upon the majority of Americans. It's been patent what it is. And so you began to grind out from this New Left black militant body a stream of violent, scurrilous anti-Israel activity, the glorification of the terrorists. And anti-Israel was simply a code word for anti-Semite. And quickly, the Israelite who presumably was abusing the colored refugee in Gaza became the Israelite who was abusing the poor black in the center city of America. And unfortunately, this propaganda began to catch on. And among black intellectuals of the more militant mood, they began to use the word Jew as a code word for whitey, for all whites. Because most of the blacks had recognized that you can't fight 90% of the polity. You can't fight the entire nation. And the white man is too diffuse, too broad a target. It was far easier to talk of the Jew, to specify the corner storekeeper, to specify a particular landlord. And interestingly, many who were not Jews came to be called Jews. Jew became the word by which you identified the enemy. And they began to pick up not only the Arab literature, but the anti-Semitic literature, which has always been rampant in the West, and to disseminate most of this. And all of a sudden, we began to see, can be seen in Poland or in Russia today, what we saw in Germany 25 years ago, what we saw in Eastern Europe 30 and 40 years before that, what we saw in France and in England 50 years before that, the deliberate use of the most ancient hate of Western man in order to promote one particular political party or political ideology, to promote its cause in an attempt to gain large numbers of followers. Now, how widespread is this movement? Black militancy tends to be a very limited phenomenon, despite what we read in the newspapers. The black militancy has now linked up with white militancy. And the white New Left has begun to take over and to spew out this anti-Israel, anti-Semitic propaganda. There have been many instances of this. I read just this week of one at Wayne State University nearby Detroit, whereby the New Left and the Afro-Asian Society decked every one of the tack boards in the Wayne State Library with the most scurrilous type of literature, on the one hand glorifying the El Fateh, the terrorists, on the other hand, accusing Israel of all kinds of false crimes against the refugees, and on the third, accusing the Jew of all kinds of crimes against the slum people. Now, in and of itself, of course, the new left, whether it's black or white, could not threaten the security of the Jew in America. It's too small a part of the body politic. It's too far from the centers of power. And all the talk that we can do about the absolute incredibility of this link-up between the black cause in America and the cause of the Arabs against Israel will not get through. You can say to these three few thousand ideologues, look, who were the great slave traders of history? The Arabs. What literature has more black stereotypes, more ugliness against the black race than any other? Arabic literature. What is the one people in the world who today are conducting genocide against the blacks? The Arabs of the Sudan against the black southern tribesmen of the Sudan. What is the one small country in the world which has given technical aid and human assistance to the emerging black nations of Central Africa? And that nation is Israel. The link up of the black cause in America and the Arab cause in the Middle East makes no rational sense whatsoever. But ideology isn't necessarily rational. It thrives more almost in folly than in reason. So the link-up has been made, and it's real. And because the black community of the United States, just as the white community of the United States, has been nurtured and conditioned to assume that the Jew is somehow different, somehow alien, somehow suspect, potentially the enemy, so this propaganda has made some inroads in the larger black community, the non-militant, the non-ideologue community. It's been opposed, fortunately, by many of their leaders, men like Roy Wilkins. But it's made inroads. And if you read the reports of meeting after meeting after meeting, you'll hear the Jew somehow singled out, somehow the target, somehow the enemy. But even this would not be of that much concern to us if our long history did not reveal something else. And that is that the minority demanding its rights, threatening with violence the security of the community, often links up with the establishment, with the upper class, with the power group. Because the power group wants to buy peace at any price. It needs to protect its privilege. It often finds that the Jew is a useful, available target to deflect the anger of the mob against. Let me read you two paragraphs, which were published recently by the Director of Community Relations of the San Francisco Jewish Community Federation, a man by the name of Rab. They are very perceptive. The same point is being made for the Jews by the kind of expressive anti-Semitism that are emerging from this black expressivism. This is not the folk anti-Semitism which the black population shares with the white population. It is rather the abstract and symbolic anti-Semitism which Jews instinctively find more chilling. Negroes trying to reassure Jewish audiences repeatedly and unwittingly make the very point they are trying to refute. This is not anti-Semitism, they say. The hostility is towards the whites. When they say Jew, they mean white. But that is an exact and acute definition of political anti-Semitism. The enemy becomes the Jew. The man becomes the Jew. The villain is not so much the actual Jewish merchant on the corner as the corporate Jew who stands symbolically for generic evil. Don't be disturbed, the Jews are told. This is just poetic excess. But the ideology of political anti-Semitism has precisely always been poetic excess, which has never prevented it from becoming murderous. However, there is another more problematic area of concern that might be anticipated if the expressive black movement continues to grow. The black community is on the verge of a major political breakthrough. A good number of cities are soon destined to be numerically controlled or heavily dominated by their Negro populations. These are the cities in or around which most American Jews live, and in which their business and public lives are largely conducted. If the expressive black movement with attendant political anti-Semitism continues to grow, its effect on Jewish lives will be incalculable. Incalculable also might be the effect on American foreign policy in the Middle East of a prevailing anti-Israel sentiment in important political centers. There will, of course, be an intensification of the upward mobility conflict that is already becoming a visible part of the Negro-Jewish complex. More generally, the political structure in our cities is going to be under considerable strain. There is the possibility of a classic marriage, a manipulative symbiosis between the privileged class and the disprivileged mass. In this case, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant class and a black mass. In these cities, the kind of symbiosis which existed in the 1920s between respectable Republican leaders and the Ku Klux Klan and which permitted a temper of repression and bigotry to flourish. The anti-Semitic ideology developing in the black movement would be eminently suited to such purposes. Some have suggested that the edges of this possibility are actually peeking out in New York City. Certainly, whatever the outcome, this face of the black expressive movement is there for the Jewish community to contemplate with justified concern. Now, what are the edges of this possibility which may be peeking out in New York City? In the first place, there is the history of the New York teachers' strike. How many of us realize that for many months before the strike, the New York Teachers Union was committed to the cutting up of this vast system into a number of neighborhood areas, decentralization. But that, in fact, what happened was that in the long discussions between the Ford Foundation and the mayor's office and the school board, and of course the black community, no one bothered to contact the teachers and to ask them precisely what their rights and their needs were if this decentralization program had to go into effect. Such was the urgency of the establishment to solve the problems of violence and tumult at the level of the grassroots that no one bothered to ask those who were caught in the crunch, the professionals, the teachers, what they felt their rights were and how they needed to be protected and encouraged during this period of transition. This kind of blindness to the need of one group who happened to be largely Jewish and happened to be largely middle-class, non-powerful, and middle-class, non-violent is a classic example of the spiritual blindness with which I spoke at the beginning. Then there was the incident on which I've already commented from this pulpit, the incident at New York University, where an Afro-American Studies Center was created in the name of Martin Luther King, and a black man appointed to head it, whose credentials include the fact he'd written during the school crisis a number of articles which in effect accused the Jewish teachers of New York of intellectual genocide against their black students. And when this was brought to the attention of the upper-class board, the trustees of NYU, and of the WASP president of NYU, he said that the Jewish community was overreacting, that there was nothing to worry about, that all was as it should be, that we had to understand the poetic excess of language, of anger. The man was appointed, Mr. Hatcher, and he began to continue these fulminations against the Jewish teachers and cultural genocide, as he called it, and things of this kind. No one, despite the protest of the Jewish community in New York, no one was prepared to take any action against him. But one day, in an excess of oratory, he attacked not only Albert Shanker, the president of the Teachers Union in New York, as a racist bastard, but he included in this condemnation the two presidential candidates, Mr. Humphrey and Mr. Nixon. And the very next day, he was summarily dismissed from his office. Again, blindness. It's all right to attack Jews. It's all right to attack a Jewish president of a union. But when you attack and defame members of the power establishment, then your job is in jeopardy. And then you have exceeded the bonds. But what's for it? How far will this manipulative symbiosis go? No one knows. What is certain is that if tension grows in our cities, the ideologies of the radical left continue to become more dominant in the black community. Those in the white community who want to maintain their prerogatives and their privileges will desperately seek to make peace. And unless history is controverted, unless far more Americans of power have pulled themselves up by their intellectual bootstraps and pulled themselves beyond the blindness which Western man has traditionally been afflicted with when it comes to Jews, there are going to be, I'm afraid, any number of compromises, of buyings off, of violence, often at the expense of the Jew. A good friend of mine, a man who's spoken in this congregation, Dr. Lou Silberman, professor at Vanderbilt University, wrote a letter to the New York Times, which I'd like to read to you. While the tensions between the black and the Jewish communities mounts ever higher, James Reston's reassurance that New York is not the nation is cold comfort in the face of the magnitude of the confrontation. Two representatives of the class and group historically most responsible for the social, political, and economic structures that have given rise to the present agony, stand blandly above the battle. Thomas Hoving, director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and Dr. Harold Taylor. The rising black community, at last moving towards its own internal integration, is by the very nature of the circumstance brought into conflict with the most vulnerable segment of the white society, the Jewish community. In New York, the most viable of those, quote, making it, unquote. That community, sharing, as do all whites, our national guilt, but by no means its creator, is now serving to deflect the largely just anger of the black community from its rightful goal, the class and group so exquisitely exemplified by Mr. Hoving and Dr. Taylor. The vulnerability of the Jews in such situations of conflict is clearly recognizable in history. Christian Spain in the 14th and 15th centuries, Poland in the 17th, Germany in the 20th. In each instance, the wielders of power were able to direct the fury of the seekers after power from themselves by letting the mob burn the Jews. It is tragic that at this juncture, the Jewish community is unaware that this process of deflection need not be conscious. It has long since been built into the system. In the present instance, it would seem futile to appeal for intervention to those who have the most to gain, their own immunity. Present wielders of power will effectively intervene only at the point of self-interest. Appeals to the blacks may fall on equally deaf ears, for if they believe they can come to participate in the exercise of power, and that is basically what is involved, if they can believe this by embracing anti-Jewish sentiments and attitudes, that is their Americanization, they will undoubtedly take that option, however regretfully, on the part of many. Perhaps there are other options open for all concerned. One could hope that such is the case. What's the solution, then, to this potential problem of political anti-Semitism on the American scene? The answer, I'm afraid, is that there may be no solution. We've never found one in history. Outside our own state, Jews have simply not been powerful enough to control the economy and to control the politics of the nation sufficiently to prevent the emerging of precisely this kind of confrontation. And that's why, the way, why I am and have been and remain a Zionist. But we're also human beings, creatures of hope. We must do our share. We must take the chance. We must, however we examine the situation, work desperately to support our rights, to secure our opportunity. What's for it in this direction? What do we need to do in this direction? In the first place, I think we need to be very clear as to why political anti-Semitism has any chance of surfacing at this moment in time. And the reasons are two. The social unrest brought upon by the rightful demands of the black minority for a share in the American political structure, and the determination by a small group that they're going to use this passion, this drive, not necessarily for the civil and economic rights of the black, but to impose upon the black revolution their own definition of what that revolution should be. The first case imposes upon us the responsibility of doing all that we can to make it possible for the black community and the Mexican-American community and the Puerto Rican community, all the outs in American society, to move into that society with maximum possible speed. And this means concern with the war on poverty, concern with civil rights, concern with levels of subsistence, concern with the educational system, concern with the amenities of living in a city, concern with public housing, concern with compensatory education, every one of the 100 concerns which all of us know are required to begin to solve the problems which threaten the traditional unity of American life. And in the second case, I think it's long past due that even as we plunge ahead with all the power that we have to make America a better America, that we destroy one blinding image which precludes us from seeing the blacks as individuals, which makes us see them only as a group, and only with the eyes of a presumed inherited guilt, which makes us feel that all that is asked by any of them in their name is in fact right, something we must agree to. Black is not beautiful any more than white is beautiful. The blacks have a just case, but not all blacks. The whites have failed miserably to do what must be done, but not all whites. And it's time that we understood that there is not only the legitimate movements, as we would judge them, within the black community for greater rights and greater opportunity and better education and better housing and compensatory education and better job opportunity, etc., 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 but that there is within the black community small groups of people who are determined to align their movement not only with black power, but with a third world force, with the new left, with the positions of Mao or the Soviet Union, who are fundamentally un-American, and that these people must not be helped and must not be encouraged. And that when we do put our support, we must be very clear whom we are supporting. There's a vast difference between a Roy Wilkins struggling with every ounce of fiber and judgment he possesses for a better America, and a Stokely Carmichael who is struggling with every ounce of power which he possesses for his own benefit and for the revolution in America. And the revolution he wants is not simply a racial revolution. As far as I understand it, it's simply that Stokely Carmichael becomes president of the United States with all powers. Seems to me that beyond this, we Jews have to be very touchy. For most of our lives, we've been trained not to overreact. We hear an anti-Semitic joke. We hear an anti-Semitic comment. We've learned to bite our tongue. We've learned not to intrude at the table from which it emerges. We just let it pass us by. But when the anti-Semitism, which is expressed affects a public institution or the structuring of power in the city, when it's a threat to our security, then silence is folly. The New York Jewish community has been accused of overreacting to the brochure at the Metropolitan Museum, to the school crisis, to a poet reading on the air, the most scandalous kinds of anti-Semitic activity. If anything, they underreacted. Because what they saw and read clearly, was an indication that as long as the Jew was quiescent and silent, no one would pay attention to their rights. And when they finally did react, suddenly the mayor's office and other places of power in New York City began to realize there were Jews and they had to be considered. And a man who was head of the Commission on Human and Civil Rights in New York, who for years had paid no attention to the claims of the Jews that here or there, there were anti-Semitic activities taking place. Suddenly this man was dismissed and replaced with another. Only those who will stand up and be counted in this struggle will in fact count. We're going, I'm afraid, into difficult times. The difficulty of these times will be measured by the strength of the economy in our nation, by the speed with which we are moving to solve the crisis in human relations, justice in our communities. We Jews enter this period of crisis for the entire nation with a double burden, not only the burden that all ordinary citizens bear, but the danger that we can be caught between the upper and the nether millstone. And we Jews have been here before. We know that there are some, hopefully many, in the community beyond who have outgrown their innate prejudices. We know that unless we will stand up and demand our rights, no one will give them to us. The Jews of Germany were silent. The Jews of America must surely have learned a lesson. It cannot be. Amen.